60 Minutes, coming up next.
So I was recently looking to buy a new car, and I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. And that's when a friend of mine told me about this new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car that you're looking at in your area, so you know if you're getting a good price. Because here's what happens. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer. You can't beat it. Save time, save money, never overpay. If you're going to buy a car, go to TrueCar.com today.
Tonight on this special edition of 60 Minutes Presents, Crime and Punishment.
That's the apartment.
That corner on the third floor.
The apartment belonged to Boston mobster and longtime fugitive Whitey Bulger, then the most wanted man in America. Bulger eluded the FBI for 14 years by hiding in plain sight in Santa Monica, California. Tonight, you'll hear from the agents who finally caught him with some help from an alley cat and his girlfriend's breast implants.
We just rushed him.
You mean guns out, FBI,
sure.
Don't move?
I asked him to identify himself, and that didn't go over well. He asked me to effing identify myself, and I asked him, I said, are you Whitey Bulger? He said yes.
If they sound like Nazis, it's because they are. The largest neo-Nazi group in America rallying in Trenton, New Jersey.
This isn't dress-up. This isn't a game. We're fighting for our children's future.
Jeff Hall was the movement's rising star.
We are not afraid of you!
Who was murdered at point-blank range in his own home. What's astonishing about this story was who did it.
The prosecution says you're a con man, a thief. What do you say to that?
Barry Landau pulled off the single largest theft of historic artifacts in the United States. Thousands of items, including signed documents by George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Francis Scott Key, and Mark Twain. And for 20th century buffs,
one third of a nation.
FDR's copy of his 1937 inaugural address.
All of these were found in Landau's apartment?
All these documents were seized from Mr. Landau's apartment in New York City.
Good evening. I'm Steve Croft. Tonight on 60 Minutes Presents, three stories about crime and punishment. We begin with the Gascos. Charlie and Carol Gasco were an elderly couple who moved to Santa Monica, California, sometime in early 1997 to begin a new phase of their life. For the next 14 years, they did almost nothing that was memorable, and they would be of absolutely no interest if it weren't for the fact that Charlie Gasco turned out to be James Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston gangster and longtime fugitive who recently began serving two life sentences. Carol Gasco was actually Catherine Gregg, Whitey's longtime girlfriend and caregiver. As we first told you in November, the story of how they managed to elude an international manhunt for so long while hiding in plain sight is interesting. And tonight, you'll hear it from the Gasco's neighbors and from federal agents who finally unraveled the case with the help of a boob job and an alley cat. If you're forced into retirement with a comfortable nest egg and a desire to be left completely alone, there is no better place than Santa Monica, California. This low-key seaside suburb of L.A. is shared by transients and tourists, hippies and hedonists, celebrities, and lots of senior citizens, attracted to the climate and an abundance of inexpensive rent-controlled apartments just a few blocks from the ocean. Places like the Princess Eugenia on 3rd Street, which is where Charlie and Carol Gasco, a childless couple from Chicago, lived for 14 years without attracting much attention from longtime neighbors or landlords. Josh Bond is the building manager.
What were they like?
They were like the nice, retired old couple that lived in the apartment next to me.
Good tenants?
Excellent tenants. Never complained. Always paid rent on time.
In cash?
In cash.
Janice Goodwin lived down the hall.
They had nothing. And they never went out. They'd never had food delivered. She never dressed nicely.
You thought they were poor?
Yes, without a doubt.
The one thing everyone remembers about the Gascos is that they loved animals and always made a fuss over the ones in the neighborhood. Barbara Gluck remembers that Carol Gasco always fed a stray cat after its owner had died.
She would you know, pet it and be sweet to it. And then she would put a plate of food, like, out here. Mm-hmm.
And she liked the cat.
Obviously. She loved the cat. And we all liked the cat, but she was taking care of the cat.
And what about Charlie Gasco?
You know, he always had a hat on and dark glasses. I have to say, it was mysterious to me why a lovely woman like that was hanging out with that guy, that old grumpy man. I never could figure that one out until I heard they had $800,000-something in the wall. And then I went, oh, okay, you know.
Money wasn't the only thing found in the Gasco's apartment on June 22, 2011, when the FBI stopped by and ended what it called the most extensive manhunt in the Bureau's history.
Weapons all over the apartment. I mean, weapons by his nightstand, weapons under the windowsill, shotguns, mini Rugers, rifles.
Loaded.
Loaded, ready to go.
What had started out as a routine day for Special Agent Scott Gariola, who was in charge of hunting fugitives in L.A., would turn into one of the most interesting days of his career. After getting a call to stake out a building in Santa Monica, he notified his backup team with the LAPD.
I had four guys working that day, and they said, we got a tip on Whitey Bulger, and I'll see you there in about an hour. And invariably, the text will return, who's Whitey Bulger?
Really?
A few of them. So I had to remind him, gently remind him, who Whitey Bulger was.
That he was number one on the FBI's most wanted list.
Number one. Number one, yeah. Big East Coast figure, but in the West Coast, not so much.
Mention any cartel leader.
The cops in L.A. were focused on gangbangers and cartel members, not some retired Irish mobster who hadn't been spotted in 16 years. But then few mobsters have ever been as infamous in a city as Whitey Bulger was in Boston, and his reputation was for more than just being grumpy. Besides extortion and flooding the city with cocaine, Bulger routinely performed or ordered executions, some at close range, some with a hail of bullets, and at least one by strangulation, after which it's said he took a nap. Special Agent Rich Tian, who ran the FBI's Whitey Bulger Fugitive Task Force, had heard it all.
Bulger was charged with 19 counts of murder. He was charged with other crimes. He was a scourge to the society in South Boston, his own community.
He was also a scourge to the FBI and a great source of embarrassment to Tian, Special Agent Phil Torsney, and others on the FBI task force. Years earlier, Whitey Bulger had infiltrated the Boston office of the FBI and bought off agents who protected him and plied him with information, including the tip that allowed Bulger to flee just days before he was to be indicted.
We really had to catch this guy to establish credibility after all the other issues, and it was just a matter of bringing this guy back to Boston to make sure this guy didn't die or get away with this thing.
Torsney, who's now retired, and Agent Tommy McDonald joined the task force in 2009. The joke was Bulger was on the FBI's least wanted list. There hadn't been a credible lead in more than a decade, and their efforts in Bulger's old neighborhood of South Boston were met with mistrust and ridicule.
Some people, they told us right out front, you guys aren't looking for that guy. People just made the assumption we had him stashed somewhere. I mean, people really thought that kind of thing.
Despite that mindset that we're not going to help you, the FBI still got it done.
Took 16 years.
Took 16 years. Yeah, this was not a typical fugitive.
The FBI says Bulger had planned his getaway years in advance, with money set aside and a fake identity for a Thomas Baxter. During his first 2 years on the lam, Bulger was in touch with friends and family, shuttling between New York, Chicago, and the resort town of Grand Isle, Louisiana, where he rented a home until his identity was compromised. After that, it seemed as if Bulger had disappeared from the face of the earth, except for the alleged sightings all over the world.
How many of these tips do you think might have been true?
Boy, there was thousands and thousands of tips, and I think, I don't think any of them were true.
One of the obstacles was there were really no good photographs of Bulger or his longtime live-in girlfriend, Catherine Gregg, a former dental hygienist. The FBI often noted that the couple shared a love of animals, especially dogs and cats, and asked veterinarians to be on the lookout. There were reports that Gregg once had breast implants and other plastic surgery in Boston, so the task force reached out to physicians. Eventually, they got a call from a Dr. Matthias Donnellan, who had located her files in storage.
I was trying to leave the office a little early to catch one of my kids' ball games. And I said, well, listen, I'm going to swing by in the morning and pick those up. And they said to me, do you want the photos, too? And I said, you have photos? And they say, yeah, we have photos. And I said, we'll be there in 15 minutes.
The breast implant lead produced a treasure trove of high-resolution Catherine Gregg photographs that would help crack the case. The FBI decided to switch strategies, going after the girlfriend in order to catch the gangster.
This is an announcement by the FBI.
The FBI created this public service announcement.
60-year-old Grieg is the girlfriend of 81-year-old Bulger.
It ran in 14 markets on daytime talk shows aimed at women.
Call the tip line at 1-800-CALL-FBI.
And it didn't take long. The very next morning, the Bulger task force got three messages from someone that used to live in Santa Monica and was 100% certain that Charlie and Carol Gasco, apartment 303 at the Princess Eugenia Apartments, were the people they were looking for. The descriptions and the age difference matched, and Deputy U.S. Marshal Neil Sullivan, who handled the lead, said there was another piece of tantalizing information.
The tipster specifically described that they were caring for this cat and their love for this cat. So that was just one piece of the puzzle and the tip that just added up to saying, if this isn't them, it's something we better check out immediately because it sure sounds like them.
A search of the FBI's computer database for the Gascos raised another red flag, not for what it found, but for what it didn't.
Basically, like they were ghosts.
No driver's license.
Exactly. No driver's license, no California ID, like they didn't exist.
That's the apartment.
That corner on the third floor.
On the right-hand side?
Yep.
By early afternoon, FBI agent Scott Gariola had set up a number of surveillance posts and had already met with apartment manager Josh Bond to talk about his tenants.
He closed the door, threw down a folder and opened it up and said, are these the people that live in apartment 303?
Did you say anything when you saw the pictures?
My initial reaction was, holy
You're living next door to a gangster.
Well, I still didn't really know who he was.
But it didn't take him long to figure it out. While the FBI was mulling its options, Bond logged on to Bulger's Wikipedia page.
I'm just kind of scrolling down. It's like, oh, wow, this guy's serious. It's like murders and extortion. And then I get to the bottom, and there's this thing. It's like from one of his old people saying, well, the last time I saw him, he said, you know, when he goes out, he's going to have guns, and he's going to be ready to take people with him. I was like, ooh, maybe I shouldn't be involved in this.
I mean, we're sitting here laughing about it, but he's a pretty serious guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He killed a lot of people.
True.
Or had them killed.
I didn't know that at the time.
Bond told the FBI he wasn't going to knock on the Gasco's door because there was a note posted expressly asking people not to bother them. Carol had told neighbors that Charlie was showing signs of dementia.
So we were back there.
So Gariola devised a ruse involving the Gasco's storage locker in the garage.
Had the name Gasco across it, and apartment 303.
He had the manager called to tell them that their locker had been broken into and that he needed someone to come down to see if anything was missing. Carol Gasco said her husband would be right down.
We just rushed him.
Mimi, guns out, FBI,
sure.
Don't move.
Gave the words, hey, FBI, get your hands up. And hands went up right away. And then at that moment, we told him to get down on his knees, and he gave us... Yeah, he gave us a, I ain't getting down on my effing knees.
Didn't want to get his pants dirty.
Didn't want to get his pants dirty. You know, wearing white and seeing the oil on the ground, I guess he didn't want to get down in oil.
Even at 81, this was a man used to being in control.
I asked him to identify himself, and that didn't go over well. He asked me to effing identify myself, which I did. And I asked him, I said, are you Whitey Bulger? He said, yes. Just about that moment, someone catches my attention from a few feet away by the elevator shaft.
It was Janice Goodwin from the third floor coming to do her laundry.
And I said, excuse me, I think I can help you. This man has dementia, so if he's acting oddly, you know, that could be why.
Immediately what flashed through my mind is, oh, my God, I just arrested an 81-year-old man with Alzheimer's who thinks he's Whitey Bulger. What is he going to tell me next? He's Elvis? So I said, do me a favor. I said, this woman over here says you have a touch of Alzheimer's. He said, don't listen to her. She's effing nuts. He says, I'm James Bulger.
A few minutes later, he confirmed it, signing a consent form allowing the FBI to search his apartment.
As he's signing, he says, that's the first time I've signed that name in a long time.
Was there a feeling of resignation?
I don't think he had it. I did ask him, I said, hey, Whitey, I said, aren't you relieved that you don't have to look over your shoulder anymore and you know, it's come to an end? And he said, "Are you nuts?"
But in some ways, Whitey Bulger and Catherine Gregg had already been prisoners in apartment 303, which appeared to be a mixture of the murderous and the mundane. Alongside the weapons and all the money, they had stockpiled a lifetime supply of cleansers, creams, and detergents. The FBI took special interest in a collection of 64-ounce bottles with white socks stretched over the top.
I said, "Hey, Whitey, what are these? Are these some kind of Molotov cocktail you're making?" He goes, "No." He said, "I buy tube socks from the 99-cent store, and they're too tight on my calves. That's the way I stretch them out." I said, "Why are you shopping at the 99-cent store? You have $500,000 under your bed." He goes, "I had to make the money last."
It's been said that one of the reasons it took so long to catch Whitey Bulger is that people were looking for a gangster, and Bulger, whether he liked it or not, had ceased to be one.
He said it was hard to keep up that mindset of a criminal, and that's part of the reason he came down to that garage. He said if he was on his game, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago, he probably would have sensed something there. But he said it was hard to stay on that edge, that criminal edge, after being on the lam as a regular citizen for 15 years.
The master manipulator gave credit to Catherine Gregg for keeping him crime-free, hoping it would mitigate her sentence. She's now serving 8 years for harboring a fugitive. On the long plane ride back to Boston, Bulger told his captors that he became obsessed with not getting caught and would do anything to avoid it, even if it meant obeying the law. Whitey Bulger's biggest fear, they said, was being discovered dead in his apartment, and he had a plan to avoid it.
If he became ill and knew he was on his deathbed, he'd go down to Arizona, crawl down the bottom of one of these mines and die and decompose and hope that we would never find him and still be looking for him forever.
It was a startling case that made headlines. An American neo-Nazi leader murdered in his home in Riverside, California. His name was Jeff Hall. He was a burly man, 6'3", a devoted father of 5 young children, and a plumber who had been unemployed for 3 years. Jeff Hall was shot in his living room at point blank range. But as Leslie Stahl first reported in September 2011, what was most astonishing was who shot him.
"We've been through a lot together, some of us, you know, seriously."
This is 32-year-old Jeff Hall. These pictures were taken just hours before he was executed, right in this room. The executioner, this child, his son, his 10-year-old son. But if you find this image disturbing, consider this one taken 2 weeks earlier. A neo-Nazi rally on the streets of Trenton, New Jersey.
"Whose streets?
Our
streets!
Whose streets?
Our streets!
Whose streets?
Our streets!
Jeff Hall was a rising star in the largest neo-Nazi group in the country, the National Socialist Movement, or NSM.
"You know where to find me."
The numbers nationwide are still small, 500 members tops, but they're growing.
"This isn't dress-up. This isn't a game. We're fighting for our children's future."
According to Jeff Hall and the NSM, that future would be an all-white, non-Semitic America.
"There's other groups I could join. There's tons of them."
Jeff Hall joined only 2 years earlier. But seen as personable and charismatic, he quickly became the leader of the NSM in California, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada. This footage was shot by Julie Plattner, a filmmaker and photographer who was able to gain the NSM's trust.
"How you doing, Miss Julie?"
And enter their closed world of private meetings.
"Julie has me mic'd."
She quickly honed in on Jeff Hall.
"Jeff, nice to meet you."
Jeff Hall cultivated a sense of family among his new recruits.
"Yeah, we did good."
Holding his monthly meetings at his house with the kids around, including his son Joseph. These gatherings were a strange mix of Nazi propaganda.
"And that's how we apply what we learned from Mein Kampf."
And party games.
"I got all the right answers, guys."
"Happy birthday."
A birthday celebration topped off by... Jeff's mother, Joanne Patterson, went to some of her son's meetings, despite abhorring her son's politics.
"I wanted to make sure it was okay for my grandkids to be there. And I had a great time. It looked like any barbecue in any backyard in America.
The
But they were Nazis.
Well, they...
We're just sitting here talking about Nazis.
I know, it's crazy.
They're in your own family.
I know, it's crazy, huh?
My son became a Nazi.
Yeah, a Nazi leader.
We start at 12.
On Saturday, April 30th, 2011, her son held what would be his last get-together. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary, to the extent this is ordinary. 10-year-old Joseph was running in and out of the house.
Coming outside, Manny.
All the kids were.
Okay, come here.
Dad even took some of them to see his Nazi glow-in-the-dark T-shirt with its SS insignia.
Just little things in life.
This is the last recorded image of Jeff Hall alive. After people left that night, the family watched a movie, Yogi Bear, as Jeff slept on the couch. The others went upstairs to bed. Then, at 4:02 a.m.,
911 emergency.
My son shot my husband. I need an ambulance. He's bleeding.
How old is your son?
10.
How old is your son?
10. Oh, my God.
You were the first detective at the scene after the murder. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Detective Greg Rowe saw Jeff Hall dead on the couch. He says little Joseph, who was found hiding upstairs under his covers, described calmly how he had gotten the family's Rossi 357 Magnum from his dad's closet.
Went downstairs and shot his dad. He described how he used his four fingers to cock the gun and used two fingers to pull the trigger, and he pointed it at his ear.
This was not a case of a kid thinking it was a toy and letting it go off by accident.
There's no evidence that this was anything but intentional.
Prosecutor Michael Socchio.
When he was taken into juvenile hall, he was so little, they didn't have shoes to fit him. So they had to go out and buy him a little pair of tennis shoes. He asked if he'd be able to keep the shoes when he left, which showed an absolute lack of understanding of what was going to be happening.
The Department of Justice reports only 9 cases of a 10-year-old killing a parent since 1980. But then, how many American kids are raised by a Nazi?
When you heard that the victim was the head of the local Nazi organization, did you just think to yourself that that had something to do with it?
When I first heard it, I thought there's got to be some connection with Nazi views, with guns, with weapons, with violence.
Hate speech.
Hate speech.
Yeah.
Sure.
That was just about everyone's assumption. So we set out to discover why Jeff Hall became a Nazi in the first place.
I think the biggest factor that contributed was the economy. When the housing market just fell apart in California, he had no work. He hadn't worked for 3 years.
He was in construction.
He was in construction.
And that side of the economy just completely dried up.
Completely dried up. And he tried and tried and tried to get work. And it's just scary. Poverty is a really scary thing.
Jeff lived in the Inland Empire, a vast stretch of California desert east of L.A. It was among the worst hit when the real estate market crashed, ranking 5th in foreclosures nationwide. Entire communities became ghost towns. Unemployment reached 15%. Jeff was poor and angry with time on his hands when he came upon Jeff Scoop, commander of the National Socialist Movement.
You have illegal aliens coming over the border, streaming over in hordes, taking American jobs.
Neo-Nazis focused their tirades lately on immigrants and the so-called browning of America, where places like California no longer have a white majority.
We're a white civil rights organization.
What does that mean?
Basically, what Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton do for the black people is what we do for white people.
Well, not exactly. I read to Commander Jeff Scoop this from the NSM's website.
All non-whites should leave this nation, peacefully or by force.
Our ideal America would be an America that's all white. That doesn't
mean... Yeah, and everybody else has to leave, peacefully or by force. Wow.
Our goal is a white homeland.
I mean, the president's not white. Our attorney general's not white. So they should leave. What about Jews?
They're also a race of people.
So they should leave.
Correct.
He knows that won't happen anytime soon, but he's preparing. 10 white supremacists of various groups were on the ballot in 2010, including 3 for Congress. One candidate seeking local office was Jeff Hall.
Jeff Hall ran for elections in California and took in almost 30% of the vote as an open national socialist.
It was a good run. It was a great run.
Beside that unsuccessful run for local water board, Jeff organized patrols at the Mexican border just a short drive from his home. They would show up fully armed with night vision equipment and round up migrants as they crossed into the U.S. 2 weeks before his death, Jeff bragged about taking his young son with him on patrol.
My son was able to operate a Gen 1 night vision and the infrared scope. At the age of 9, my son's out at the border.
So was being exposed to all that hate and talk of violence the reason Joseph murdered his dad?
You guys get your Glocks cocked and be ready to rock. We're going to the border. That's how we do it.
The more we looked, the more we realized it wasn't that cut and dried.
There might have been some things that we didn't know about Jeff that we wouldn't have liked.
Megan Hall, Jeff's sister, says she hated her brother's politics, but had always seen him as a model father.
He was an amazing father and would do anything for his kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my nephew would just look at him like he was his hero.
But in the last couple of years, the hero changed, darkened, whether it was the power of being a Nazi leader or the powerlessness of being unemployed. He drank more, she says, and was prone to striking out at his son and his wife, Krista.
My brother had shown a different side to him. Not all of the time. It was on random occasions, not predictable.
He was beating up both Joe and Krista, is what we heard. Is that what you've been told?
Yeah.
Young Joseph told police that he decided to kill his dad to, quote, end the son versus father thing.
Did he describe what the abuse entailed?
He described his father hitting him, kicking him, pushing him.
He found himself in a situation, or believed he was in a situation, that required some type of desperate act. What's unusual about Joseph Hall is that his solution to it was to kill. Most children don't think about what I'll need to do here is kill my father.
As the police began to dig, they discovered that little Joseph was a volatile and violent child who had been kicked out of several schools for attacking students and staff, once nearly choking a teacher with a phone cord.
My grandson was who he was from the time he was born.
What do you mean?
He has absolutely no understanding of cause and effect.
It is so rare that a 10-year-old would kill a father.
Well, but, you know, I wasn't surprised by it. I just somehow felt it could always happen, but I thought it would be when he was older.
Would this have happened if Jeff had not become a Nazi?
I think so. Probably later. Joe was still Joe, and they weren't having a lot of luck figuring out exactly what his problems were or how to deal successfully with them.
Little Joseph also had a history of starting fires.
Does he raise the question of whether a killer can be pre-programmed?
I think he had everything physically in place that it didn't take much to bring him right along to thinking that murder is inappropriate.
So he was born the match, and that environment in that home lit the match. Is that a fair way to say it?
I think it's a very fair way to say it.
After the murder, Jeff's mom got custody of his 4 girls because his wife pled guilty to leaving a loaded gun in the house. And every week, Joanne visited her son's young killer in juvenile hall.
It's a struggle every minute of my life because my son was murdered and I want justice for him. But only happens at the expense of my grandson.
What about politics with these children? I mean, what do you feel any obligation to teach them about Nazis?
They're being raised conservative Republican.
Not
we need
Nazis.
More of those in California.
But what about Nazism?
It's gone for this family.
Last year, at age 13, Joseph Hall was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 10 years in juvenile prison. American history is housed in the National Archives, 44 of them spread all over the country. They contain documents, photos, maps, artifacts that go way back to the Founding Fathers. Every school kid knows about some of them, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. But there are millions of others, from the patent for Michael Jackson's moonwalking shoes to Benedict Arnold's loyalty oath. Many are priceless treasures, which means they attract not only scholars, but thieves. More and more of them all the time. Getting to the crooks before they get to the archives has become a new priority in law enforcement. And as Bob Simon reported a year and a half ago, no one knows more about this than Barry Landau, a self-described presidential historian and one of the leading collectors of presidential memorabilia. That's because Barry Landau carried out the largest theft of these treasures in American history. Prosecutors say he is one of the most accomplished con men they've ever encountered.
For decades, he was a regular guest at the White House. Here he is with President Ford and Queen Elizabeth. He's the guy with the beard.
Well.
He showed up with President Reagan and Nancy at the inaugural gala in 1985 and met a whole bunch of presidents. Richard Nixon, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton. He wrote an impressive, picture-laden book, The President's Table, and was invited to the finest anchor desks in town.
Barry H. Landau is a presidential historian.
The story of the ultimate inauguration collector.
But when we met up with him in June 2012, he no longer wanted to tell his story. He'd been convicted of the single largest theft of historic artifact in the United States. He stole thousands of items, including hundreds of documents signed by some of the most famous names in history: George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Francis Scott Key, Marie Antoinette, Voltaire. He'd pilfered them from museums and libraries all over the country. U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein was in charge of the prosecution.
He was a con man?
Barry Landau was a con artist, and he used his reputation as a presidential historian in order to gain the confidence of museums and other people who had custody of important documents, and then he stole them.
It was a reputation, it turns out, that was the product of his rich imagination. Landau claimed he'd worked for every president since Lyndon Johnson, had served as chief of protocol at the White House.
But in fact, there's no evidence that Barry Landau was ever employed by any White House or had any of the relationships that he claimed to have, or indeed had any legitimate job at all.
The Landau case and a few others let law enforcement know they had a problem they hadn't really been aware of until very recently.
Every institution now that has collections is threatened. We all know that there's a major threat and it's getting larger.
Former Secret Service employee Paul Brockfield is the Inspector General of the National Archives. He runs the tiny and little-known archival recovery team, armed federal agents and historians who, along with the FBI, go after stolen national treasures.
Now, Landau, was he a good thief? Was he a good con man?
From everybody I talked to, he was a master thief because he did it over a duration of time. He shopped. He got what he shopped for.
A trusted researcher and regular at libraries around the country, Landau's strategy, along with his accomplice, they conquered with kindness, as they did here at the Maryland Historical Society, where Pat Anderson is the director.
Some thieves work with knives, others with guns. These guys worked with cupcakes.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. They brought us cupcakes. And the second time they visited, they brought cookies. Evidently, they took treats to every repository they visited.
And it worked.
It did work.
But on July 9th, 2011, the esteemed Mr. Landau got careless, and Pat Anderson's archivists got suspicious, caught them stealing, and called the police.
How many things did they have when they were caught?
They had 60 pieces of our library material.
Okay, now this is some of the stuff they stole. Tell me what we're looking at.
They're inauguration souvenirs.
From which inaugurations?
This is Grover Cleveland. And these are fun. Tickets to Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial in U.S. Senate. And they grabbed a fistful of those.
I bet. There wasn't much security at the Maryland Historical Society, but still, how do you walk out in front of the librarian's desk with 60 documents? The secret was sartorial, deep pockets.
And those are his costumes.
These are the jackets that Mr. Landau used and he had altered in order to steal items from the historical societies. Now, what's interesting about these coats is that he arranged for a tailor to install interior pockets, hidden pockets inside the jackets that are large enough to fit these documents.
Landau had a whole collection of them, including a trench coat.
How did you react when you saw his jackets?
Fascinated. Again, in my world, every criminal is different. Every thief is different. And you just always, you kind of respect them. You kind of learn from them.
After the bust in Maryland, Inspector General Brockfield on the FBI decided it would be a good idea to get a search warrant for Landau's apartment in New York.
It was your agents who broke into Landau's apartment. How did they react when they found what they found?
Well, my focus was getting them a truck, because when we got to Mr. Landau's apartment, we came to the quick realization that we needed a truck. This was by far, in terms of quantity, the largest amount of documents and artifacts that we've ever recovered from one site.
10,000 items, including 300 of extraordinary historical value. What were they worth on the market?
I think the value was astronomical. For me, it's so difficult to put an empirical number on them. It's basically how much the market would bear. For all I know, to some collector, one document might have been worth millions.
All of these were found in Landau's apartment?
All these documents were seized from Mr. Landau's apartment in New York City.
There were remarkable documents. Letters signed by Mark Twain, Sir Isaac Newton, Charles Dickens. A document penned by Lorenzo de' Medici 533 years ago. An epitaph written by Benjamin Franklin for himself.
And he wrote, "Lies here food for the worms, yet the work shall not be lost." Pretty good stuff.
A letter written by John Hancock with a real John Hancock signature. And for 20th century buffs, there was the original reading copy of FDR's 1937 inaugural address. This one.
One third of a nation, ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
It was a rainy day. And in fact, the reading copy of the speech, the document the president read from that day, was waterlogged. And you can see that on the document that we seized from Mr. Landau.
And Landau didn't just steal from historical libraries. He had taken his campaign of kindness all the way to the White House, befriending President Clinton's former secretary, Betty Currie, who made the mistake of inviting Landau to her house.
Landau was pretty good at making friends with people who could help him, wasn't he? Spent nights at her place?
Bad offer to invite him into your house.
He robbed her of more than 250 items, including copies of presidential speeches from her personal collection. Naturally, we wanted to ask Barry Landau about all of this, so 2 summers ago, we tried to talk to him in New York City.
Bob Simon, 60 Minutes. Talk to us a minute.
No.
Just answer some questions. You're being accused of a lot of things, and we want to hear your side of it. They say, the prosecution says, you're a con man, a thief. What do you say to that? Don't you have anything to say at this point, in your own defense?
Landau may have been the maestro of his craft, but there have been other thieves. 2 summers ago, prosecutors put Leslie Woffen behind bars. He was in charge of the Archives, Audio and Film Records Department. He stole thousands of original recordings and sold them on eBay. Gems like this eyewitness account of the Hindenburg disaster.
It's a terrific night, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames, all the humanity.
Another employee stole most of the presidential pardons from the Philadelphia archives, as well as hundreds of photos taken by astronauts in space and on the moon.
Do you look on eBay to look for suspicious documents?
That would be one of the sites we would look at. Many times, when a thief is trying to move a document on the internet, the buyer may be a federal agent, and that's real sweet.
You're talking sting operations?
Yes.
Have you been successful with sting operations?
Yes. We ask our sentinels, our historians and collectors and dealers to help us. We go where a lot of federal employees usually aren't welcome. We'll go to gun shows. We'll go to dealer shows.
Like the Civil War Collectors' Fair in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Here, hundreds of dealers and thousands of visitors show up every year to meander and to buy. Many documents, including a few signed by Ulysses Grant and Robert E. Lee, are for sale. Have any of them been stolen from archives or museums? That's what archival recovery team agents Kelly Maltagliati and Mitch Jackelson are looking for. What would you be happiest to find?
We're missing the Wright brothers' patent. That would thrill me to no end to recover the patent for the flying machine of 1903.
When did it disappear?
We don't even know. We discovered it was missing around 2003 when a staff member had wanted to pull it for an exhibit commemorating the centennial.
Also missing, the bombing maps of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So where did these things end up?
In foreign countries, for example, in Eastern Europe, there is a market, a black market, for American historical documents.
How do these black markets function? Where are they?
Well, I think it's like any illegal market anywhere in the world. If you know of somebody who has a lot of money and wants to collect significant unique items, and you make that connection, then you may well be able to make the sale.
But Barry Landau has been put out of business. 2 summers ago, he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. And that's not all.
Even after Mr. Landau is released from prison, he will be prohibited from visiting museums, libraries, or any other places where documents are deposited.
One after effect of the Landau case is that security is being tightened in many of these places. Pat Anderson is imposing new rules in the Maryland Historical Society.
Our patrons are no longer allowed to wear jackets in the reading room. And it's unfortunate, some of our older patrons, they get chilly, and we have to say, I'm sorry. And so, they can wear a shawl, but they can't wear jackets.
You're going to have to hand out blankets.
Well, exactly, and hope that they don't have pockets in them.
And Ms. Anderson will not just be hoping, she'll be there on the front lines guarding our past.
You are the custodians of more than these documents. You're sort of the custodians of American history.
Yes, we are. We're the stewards. We make sure it gets from one generation to the next. This is what survives of the American past. We never have all of it, which is what makes what survives so much more important. These things don't belong to us. They belong to the American people.
I'm Steve Croft. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with a brand new edition of 60 Minutes.